Hey, that thing that the teacher said, they're wrong.
They're wrong!
And that thing that your comrade said, she's wrong.
She's wrong!
They are all so seriously wrong. No one knows anything, especially Aaron John. It's seriously, seriously, seriously wrong. Seriously, seriously, seriously wrong. It's seriously, seriously, seriously wrong.
Hey, well, hello everyone, and welcome back to the Seriously Wrong podcast. I am one of your co-hosts, Sean, and the other co-host is here as well.
Yeah, it's me. It's Aaron. And I'm not sick this week, and yeah, having sick. A great week.
I'm sick, so I'm at home. Yeah, I am sick. So it's funny that you mentioned that randomly.
Yeah, no, I just thought I'd introduce myself that way, but...
Huh. If anyone was wondering how we're doing, I'm fine. I'm not, like, I don't have the overbearing cognitive, like, presence in your face and your head kind of sick, but... So we're recording through via digital prophylactic. We're recording through...
Remote.
We're heavily masking.
You're in one place, I'm in another.
We're masking with geographic distance to preserve your... well-being.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, really.
But just because you're sick doesn't mean the grind can stop.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I'm taking my natto. I'm staying hydrated. Actually, working is a way that I relax, so it's totally fine. I just, forgive me for not reaching the dizzying heights that I may have in other recording.
So you're plenty dizzying.
Thank you. Yeah, and it's not all about heights. It could also be about depth. It could also be about width, at least. And then I think even diagonally across space could even have its own word if we were creative about it. A combination between width, depth, length, or all three.
Yeah, well, pilots have pitch, yaw, and roll. Yeah, when you're piloting in three-dimensional space. Anyway, that's...
That's really interesting, though. What's the second one's called? Yaw?
Yeah, one of them's called yaw. I always know that one because when you hear it, it sounds funny.
So pitch is pointing up and down. Yaw is turning left and right. And roll is rolling left or right. That makes sense.
But, and you know, with that, you can move through all the dimensions in three-dimensional space anyway.
And that's it's important to lock down before we get into the subject of today's episode.
Yeah, so in my interview last week with Cahill from Unlearning Economics, he mentioned the 4-Hour Work Week, a book, as I mentioned last week, I've read before.
It's a 2007 self-help book for aspiring business people who don't want to work so hard. Sort of entrepreneurial advice.
It is entrepreneurial advice. When I read it, I don't think I thought of myself as an aspiring businessman necessarily. I definitely heard of it on like podcasts, probably Joe Rogan or that Sphere somewhere in there. Tim Ferriss went on. But I think what captured me was the title, 4-Hour Work Week, where I was like, oh, I'm working a 40-hour work week at this hotel doing maintenance and I don't like it. Maybe this book's got some great advice for me. It helped me only work 4 hours a week. I've always disliked work, this promising me less. But it never really worked out for me that way.
Also, just for the record, for people who are newer to the podcast sphere, in 2007, 2008, the early 2010s, the connotation that Joe Rogan as a podcaster had was like pretty different than it is now. Like Joe Rogan in 2011 was one of the only media figures I was aware of who spoke positively about the Occupy movement. And it was kind of a barren field for political, and anyways, I just...
Yeah, he was more like...
I just want to give a history
vaguely
lesson.
Vaguely left liberal. He smokes weed. He supports gay rights. He thinks we should have a UBI, universal basic income. This is the Joe Rogan that I was listening to, and I don't know when I read this book, 2012, maybe 2013. I think it was before we started the podcast. But not long before.
Yeah, so I wanted to mention that just because...
Yeah, it's so different now,
There was a different kind of... Around that territory in time, there was like this different type of ideological mingling and spectrum than we have now. And Joe Rogan was in a way an embodiment of that. But 4-Hour Work Week... So the premise is that you could work significantly less hours and have more freedom. That is the basis of the book, is like 4 hours is like an extreme example, probably more than people would actually get down to. But he's saying what's meaningful in life is your free time and having enough money to live. And here's my tips as like an investor or whatever, business person, to optimize your time. So there's like a somewhat liberatory undercurrent in terms of liberating yourself from the drudgery of working way too much. There's like a fuck work angle, which resonates with me as a worker. And that's what I was familiar with through other people, like you talking about it and others. But Cahal mentioning the advice to outsource by finding low wage workers in India to like manage your schedule for you and stuff caught my imagination of in 2007, this old self-help book that I've heard about.
Yeah, that's not like something you associate with liberatory.
Yeah, like to exploit your position in the first world with access to larger amounts of money to exploit that difference to hire people at very low wages to do work. I don't know. I'm familiar with the practice, but it still was, yeah, a weird thought.
Reading it back now and looking at that section specifically, and I'm like looking for his justification for this, for like why he's saying it's okay to do this. Cause I'm like, how do you square that circle? How do you present this in a way that doesn't feel as gross as it sounds to say out loud? And yeah, it just doesn't really address it. There's some earlier discussions of geo-arbitrage and how your dollars will go farther in other countries, when like one of his pieces of advice is also go live in other countries where things are cheaper and then you don't have to have as much money to not work. So that's also threaded in there, at least implicitly. But yeah, he doesn't really address it other than saying it's like it's a good wage for them. You can pay people who have real degrees $15 an hour, like things like that is how it's presented. And it's weird reading it now, just being like, oh, it's so firmly from this perspective of you are in this extremely privileged position and here's how to take advantage of it.
Yeah.
So unselfconsciously.
Yeah. The lack of self-consciousness, I feel like taking the same advice in the current day, you'd see more self-consciousness about it. But I feel like the question of, like, we live in an unequal society in this way of, if a roll of toilet paper in your country costs as much as a bicycle in another country, and it's not your fault, is it unethical to go to another country, buy a bicycle for cheap? And I don't know, I get like the liberal market argument that it's like these are like mutually beneficial trades on an individual level. And I think the critique really is like systemic. Because of that, I don't want to say it's totally fine, but also I'm a little bit wary of saying it's totally and irrevocably wrong to hire someone at the wage they're willing to work. Yeah, it just feels like there's like a certain grossness over it all to me that's just like hard, like people are being deprived of opportunities and the ability to do things by this unequal system.
Yeah, it's weird. If you have a critique of capitalism in general and employment in general being a type of exploitation, is it then wrong to ever hire anyone to do anything because you live in capitalism? Like, yes, but also there's levels to it. And this would be like a level above that. This is like adding an extra layer potentially. But then, yeah, also in the market framework, you can argue that like you're contributing to their economy. Maybe this sector is helping people get their needs met by siphoning dollars from rich Americans who are willing to pay decent wages to do email or whatever.
Yeah, but then there's also like, just thinking of that, there's like a brain drain layer of what percentage of these like exploited economies where the natural resources are dominated by multinationals as a result of the military and economic like colonial context into the modern day in various ways. Like there's people who are going to spend their time like helping Tim Ferriss answer his emails and send love notes to his wife who, by virtue of the fact that they're able to do that fluently in another language and so on, maybe could be contributing something of value to their local context if there were better opportunities. Again, it's a structural issue more so than like Tim Ferriss, you are forbidden from hiring someone to send love letters to your wife in India for $4 an hour. Also, like Tim Ferriss is a millionaire, so that also makes it like extra.
Yeah.
Like, why not just hire? I don't know. Like, I get rich guys like to save money and then they get to be more rich.
I don't know how rich he was when he wrote this. He claims in the book anyway, neither of his parents ever made more than $50,000 combined. But he went to Princeton University and like now is some type of multimillionaire who does philanthropy and stuff. But even if it is mutually beneficial all around, there's just something gross about seeing it spelled out. Here's how to take advantage of this systemic imbalance.
Yeah, calling it automation when you're talking about hiring labor in another country that you don't interact with on a personal level very much is creepy, in the same way that like Amazon calling their like, you know, mass labor automation service Mechanical Turk when it's actually thousands and thousands of low wage workers. Creepy. Like, just the human into the mechanical aspect of that is creepy. I think it does belie some sort of like psychic vampirism, some sort of like psychic evil, something twisted going on there in the psychology of 2007 era Tim Ferriss writing this, to call people automation. The place the rubber hits the road on this, just, you want to do the right thing at the right time for the right reasons. It's possible that hiring someone in another country for a lower wage than is the minimum wage of your current jurisdiction could be the right thing. Maybe I'll leave the door open. I'd be willing to hear the case. I think the worker kind of perspective matters and the person being hired. But at the right time and for the right reasons, at the right time would mean you'd want to have some sort of necessity and context where alternative options are like not viable, or there's some great benefit to the person, some sort of disproportionate benefit. Something needs to be created there that makes it beyond just taking advantage of a low wage. Like, advising people to take advantage of low wages is also just kind of weird ethically. And then for the right reasons is also very important. And this is like the fundamental issue with this book, although I think there is some productivity tips and stuff in it that are useful or match observations that I've had. But for the right reasons would be like, towards what end? And if the end is getting like ongoing automated revenue coming into you so that you can have a leisurely life in the richest country in the world, that doesn't seem like the right reasons for me either. Although I get the appeal of wanting to do that, whatever kind of moral trade-offs exist in pursuing a human-based automation strategy like this, it would need to be an advancement of something much greater than your own individual dicking around.
Yeah, the book is like, it mixes all these different things. Like, it's business advice, it's just normal personal self-help. Like, it has these broad sections. The first one is, you know, getting out of your head or like setting expectations, like mental stuff. And then one section is for like optimizing, eliminating things that are not helping you or whatever. So there's some decent time management stuff in there. And then, yeah, the next section is automation, for getting your automated business up and running. This is where rubber hits the road in terms of 4-hour work week or something close to it. So this, to me, feels like it's going to be the core of your book. And yeah, the automation is hire foreign workers to do personal assistance stuff, and then find a niche where you can sell a product that other companies are already producing and selling, setting up your own storefront, get a really high markup on it, basically becoming a salesperson for some other company. It's a whole genre of get rich quick scheme nowadays. It's often called drop shipping. Like, his version of it is a bit more open-ended. Like, he offers a variety of, you could do it this way or that way. But like, one example is to pick a product between $50 and $200 and set it up so you don't have to manufacture anything, you don't have to do anything. And so much of the horrible shit that's on the internet nowadays, like Facebook ads for crappy products that you can get cheaper on AliExpress, like the exact same thing, maybe using AI videos of Joe Rogan to say the product is great, all these like online courses and crappy guides for workout guides or whatever guide where you have to watch a video that's too long to pay $20 to download a PDF. I'm not saying he created this, but I'm saying people trying to follow this dream of having their own personal life that's easier in a rich country by automating online. If they didn't have some really innovative idea, yeah, what they're going to end up selling is like garbage. I feel like, yeah, this is like upstream or like in the middle of the stream of so much crappy slop that's on the internet. When I think of it that way, I'm like, I really am angry about the book's effect on culture.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk now about AI slop. And this makes me think there's kind of like a category of Ferris slop, which is, it could be AI now, but like previously it wasn't AI. It used to be, even now it has this element of it of like slightly language barrier, mistranslation or like translation weirdness, low quality drop shipping product spam on the internet, and like the propagation of like storefronts across the internet that are actually like just proxies of other storefronts with markups and marketing that are quote unquote automated by low wage foreign workers. That's like a pretty awful legacy for this book. I think there's definitely a connection there.
Yeah.
And now with OpenClaw and like the new AI stuff that people are working with, we're just going to see like an acceleration of Ferris slop shall dominate more and more.
Just plug this book into a claw and ask it to make $1 million. Go.
He calls it a muse. A muse is like an automated profit-making robot that is staffed by low-wage Indian and Pakistani workers flipping things for you with your website and marketing copy or whatever. And this is part of the basis of like a good free life, which again, maybe it's possible to do that at the right time for the right reasons, but as a lifestyle hack and as a structure for society, it's obviously like the embodiment of a morally corrupted system that is advantaging you for your position in the world over people who are going to be doing the actual work.
And it's also taking advantage of customers and to just put a markup on thing and try and find the copy that best angles people into buying your product. You know, like there's some psychological warfare in marketing in general, which you're taking part in. And it just, yeah, it seems sleazier when you're saying like, and you don't even have to do any work. This shit is so slop that, you know, once you get it going, it'll just print money for you without contributing anything of value.
Especially when you distribute this out to the Joe Rogan audience and say, this is your pathway to freedom. You have people who maybe don't have the skills to do it well, and they don't have the ethics to do it right. And so then you create this wave of for-profit slop across the internet. I've got this like graph forming in my head. At the beginning is like a plump and happy lazy American. And then feeding into Mr. Plump and Happy Lazy American is like the exploited labor of the international working class, misled and exploited customers.
Yeah.
And then if I make this plump and happy American Tim Ferriss, I can add another category, which is like failed entrepreneurs buying your books who can't get in on it because there's a structural limit to how many people can be in on it.
This is, yeah, maybe I'll cut this. It's just embarrassing. So I did briefly consider being like, maybe I can set something up and then I'll be free to pursue my creative pursuits or whatever. Talking to my partner at the time, we came up with the idea that maybe the niche product we could sell would be hemp plastic dildos. I think I had just heard of hemp plastic for the first time. And I think one of the pieces of advice is to cross-sect different niches. So we were like, oh, people who like sex toys and people who like hemp will be a high overlap. And then I remember emailing some like manufacturing places that use hemp plastic for things and asking a couple basic questions about bodily safety. Cause like a few injection molding places said like, oh yeah, we could do that. And I was like, okay, like what chemicals are used? Because yeah, one of the first things researching dildos is like, oh, people put these in their bodies, so it's like a lot of the ones sold aren't safe, and just quickly was like, I'm in over my head on this. I don't think I can safely create this product in the method described in this book in my spare time after my maintenance job or whatever. I wouldn't say I put like a ton of effort into any of this or thought that it was really going anywhere, but yeah, I had that fear of like, oh, I don't want to put out a product that hurts people.
There's your mistake, socialist. Yeah, then I'm fleshing out my graph. I actually drew it and I made the overfed and happy American a clown. Another thing that connects to the misled and exploited customers category is like lack of genuine quality control or product production knowledge. Like in the example of shipping poison hemp dildos. And by the way, I think it is a great idea. Like if you can get it together, totally. I think there's definitely a market.
Yeah, it's still an open niche, so I'm giving it away now.
That's why people listen to the show, for business tips, advice, and to get their startups off the ground. But that lack of quality control and product knowledge, like that comes through drop shipping, does strike me as like another ethical red flag or hazard at minimum. It may be fine, but if you're reselling pencils that you're getting from a factory elsewhere that you can't visit, and you're doing 100% markup, or sorry, 1,000% markup on them, and it turns out that the production process is such that your customers may become sick if they use them. Yeah, it's just a big deal. And on the dildo front, like how regulated are dildos in terms of ensuring that all dildos are perfectly safe to use on mucous membranes? Unfortunately, I don't think they are fully and strictly regulated around the world.
Yeah, I think it's like Wild West out there, honestly.
It's a dildo Wild West out there when it comes to microplastics and, you know, effects on the endocrine system.
Yeah, it's phthalates. I don't know how you say it, but it's one, it sticks in my memory as a thing that you worry about.
One thing I was thinking about here, though, is so from the positive, and I think there are like elements of this book that have some useful insight, but I think the muse and automation and foreign workers thing is like uncomfortably close to the point of this book and where the 4-hour title comes from. I was thinking of like, what is like the 4-hour social revolution for economic, ecological, and social justice look like? Maybe we could talk about some of the positive aspects of this book through that framework of how we might utilize some of these self-help books and their tips and tricks. The popular ones are rarely without merit. Like the insight that having more free time may be better than having more money for people. Some of the time is like a good one.
Yeah, there's like a lot of self-help books, you're going to toss in as much very practical, very specific advice as you can that isn't brain blasting by any means, but it's useful. He talks about grouping repetitive tasks like paying bills, email, laundry, and do it all at once, thinking of it all as a one meta task. It's a good idea. It probably helps some people get a bunch of things done at once.
He's suggesting using autoresponders for emails and stuff like that to set up systems to make sure that you can like prioritize your work or like filtering your inbox and stuff like that. That's reasonably useful to a social revolutionary who's trying to create an ecological and democratic society that's a commune of communes where people are paid according to need and the world is organized like a great lending library that provides everyone with the dignity and supports they need to live fulfilled lives, take care of their families, their elders, and the next generation.
Some of the stuff that I did like in here was in the section on liberation, which is after the section on automation. He talks about escaping the office and he gives some advice on how to shirk off at work, basically, which it could be useful for a social revolutionary who wants to use more time for other pursuits. Like he suggests, call in sick for 2 days and then do a bunch of remote work on those 2 days. And then when you get back to the office, you can be like, oh, wow, it's just so easy to get all this work done at home, even though I was sick. Maybe I should work from home a bit more often because it's so much easier. I get so much done. Although, yeah, even he's like, this works for office people sometimes, but not if you're like I was at the time reading it, doing hotel maintenance where it wasn't always the busiest job, but I definitely couldn't leave. But yeah, so you might be able to manipulate your boss into letting you work from home with these kind of tactics, which, you know, it is manipulative and kind of lying, but I think in the context of employee-boss relationships, sometimes you got to use the tools available to you.
Yeah, I'd love to read a book that's like the sneaky little worker's guide to improving your work-life balance.
Right, right.
When you're working on a factory floor, you can't really shirk off the way that an office worker can. That's part of like the BS jobs thing and the move towards more administrative staff over frontline staff. It's like frontline staff don't have the ability to... If you're providing social supports to people as your job on the front lines, you can't do that from home. If you're assembling widgets in a factory, you can't do that from home. So it's like a specific group of knowledge workers he's talking to here. Knowledge workers who feel rightly disenfranchised by capitalism and then as a result are being sold an individualist fantasy as a way to escape capitalism using capitalism by shifting your position within the hierarchy of your workplace. That's the term that they use for someone who's neither an alpha nor a beta, but then they go, what is it called?
Why is it slipping my mind?
It's almost like a manosphere thing or something.
The whole alpha, beta, omega? Or no, omega's...
Oh yeah, no, I think omega...
Like I'm thinking of the omegaverse, the werewolf sex shared universe of erotica.
Omega male sounds right to me for the... It was like a meme.
I think it was a different one. I think they're like the Uber bottoms. They're like the opposite of alpha. And I think that's what it is.
Sigma.
Yes. There we go.
You got it. I just found the WikiHow page, the 7 male personalities, which is not, it says that it's fact checked here by a WikiHow staff writer, but I do not think it is fact checked that there are 7 types of male personalities that relate to.
No.
Letters of the Greek alphabet. I think that is...
I mean, it might be fact-checked that somebody has created that categorization system, that it's some sort of natural and true system, I doubt.
Yeah, so this book is a little bit of a guide to be an omega as a way to escape from office space.
Sigma.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, sorry, sigma. My mistake. I own it. I'm so foolish. What was I thinking?
This book, I wouldn't say it's like a red pill book or a manosphere book, but there's a couple things in here that just feel like he got them from reading pickup artist stuff. And he frames this not as dating advice, but just general getting out of your comfort zone advice to go up to 2 women a day or 2 members of the opposite sex. So women should go up to men and ask for their number in public. And
yeah, as a way to get better at building confidence and accepting rejection in general for the purposes of reducing your work week. But yeah, no, I think even if you are single, asking people for their phone numbers a lot is not, I don't know, it's never the way that I did it in terms of meeting people.
Yeah, the whole cold approach thing. I don't know how often that works. Like, I could definitely see it being a way to desensitize yourself to a certain type of anxiety. But a lot of these, like, he has a few other comfort challenges. He gives advice about eye contact and like talks about going to an eye contact event, which sounds interesting because everyone there agreed to sit for a few minutes at a time in a speed dating type situation where you don't talk, but just make eye contact. But he also gives the advice to on the street, maintain eye contact with people you pass until they break eye contact with you, which like... Yeah, he says not to look like a psychopath, but the unskilled in this area might not do it that well. And yeah, should you go up to people every day and make them uncomfortable in public in order to make yourself better at talking to people? No one's ever done that to me. Despite his advice here saying that women and men should do it, no women have ever come up to me in public, or men, and asked for my phone number. So I don't know what it's like, but I imagine I'd be uncomfortable. I don't think it's inherently wrong to talk to people in public if you have a genuine interest or have something to say, or yeah, you just want to get better at striking up conversation. But just reading this little script and seeing if you can get their number.
Yeah, I mean, also saying, like in this book, saying, oh, both women and men should do this is a lot like going to a Klan meeting and then saying everyone of all races come up and talk about your experience of racism. I'm sure some women have read the book, but I'd be willing to stake a financial bet on the audience. Yeah, another thing in this book that kind of gives that old school, not old school, say 20 years ago, low-key, rapey vibe, although that's not an accusation against the author. I think it's more of a cultural observation, is just talking about the financial arbitrage of taking long vacations in other countries where the cost of living is lower and so on. So you use your financial position in the first world to go to foreign countries for extended vacations where it takes less money to live and you don't have to save up as much to do it. Again, for the right time, for the right reasons. There's a local economy around these things. And yeah, maybe structurally, there's a critique of like how much of these local economies should be based around trying to extract money from rich foreign tourists versus an alternate economy that is like about autonomy. And those are the types of political conversations I expect happen around these things in these countries as well. But it really rings as, what's the term? Sexpat to me, or passport bro-y of traveling to poor countries with a lot of money to pick up women and stuff. It feels, the book isn't creepy about that, but it's just like part of the overall holistic impression of the book I have. There's a little bit of a yuck there.
Yeah, it's never framed as dating advice anywhere in the book, but I think a lot of the stuff in the book would appeal to someone who maybe thinks that if they had a bit more money or a bit more prestige, they could use that to get women or whatever. Yeah, thinking about the liberatory potential or spirit of this book, the way that it's kind of tainted by the way he frames things. And there's a whole section about liberation, but it's all about liberating yourself from the system and not even a nod towards maybe we can get together and change this thing or anything like that. It just made me think that maybe we should write our own 4-hour work week book to compete with this one directly or supplant it, maybe call it the real 4-hour work week, the true path, 4-hour work weeks for all.
Right. Yeah. That's a political vision worth fighting for. Not the individualistic liberation from responsibility and society against a backdrop of people toiling at your expense, but rather a collective liberation towards a government mandated 4-hour work week for all. That'd be pretty cool. Like it's 4 hours a week. Get your wage done. Get your wage out of the way. Really put your ass in those 4 hours and then be done. I'm in. Write that book, Wrong Boys. I'll buy it.
We're on it. We have a list of books we need to write to supplant older books that need updating with our perspective. And this one's top of the list for sure. Because, yeah, there's a reason I read this all these years ago and liked parts of it. And there's something here that needs to be fleshed out and expanded.
Yeah. And with all of our many hundreds of books that we're working on, we're chipping away at them piece by piece. And we expect they'll all be finished on the same day. And we'll release the Wrong Boys library of 250 or so currently partially finished or unstarted books. They shall arrive in one mighty wave. So you can look forward to that sometime in the next 70 years. So what's potentially liberatory that we could take from this book? He talks about the Pareto principle, like the 80-20 rule. We criticized misuse of the Pareto principle in our multi-part Jordan Peterson 12 Rules for Life series. There's some weirdness around it, and I don't want to take it too literally, but the heart of the insight that some subsection of the work you do is most productive and beneficial, that some smaller piece of the whole is carrying more than its weight in the work, and that focusing when you're trying to get projects done on achieving that piece is good advice and advice that can be used in the advancement of social transformation, I think.
Yeah, figuring out the most high impact stuff or whatever and prioritizing it. Another one actually I just remembered that really spoke to me was set very short artificial deadlines for yourself. So you feel like you're pushing up against that deadline and feeling like you got to get something done by a certain time can really help you push through the desire to just do everything and to help you again focus on the most important stuff first.
Yeah, yeah. He mentions they call it Parkinson's Law, which is that like a task will fill the container that you give it. For example, if you set a 2-hour long meeting time, people will have a 2-hour meeting, even if it could have been done in half an hour. Or if you set a 3-week deadline for a project and you set a 4-hour deadline for a project, it is possible that a version of that project could actually be done in 4 hours if you feel that urgency. And rather than exploring all the side quests that you may if you're spending multiple weeks on it. I think there's a genuine insight there, at least in the way that my brain processes urgency. Another thing, there was a thing in the book that I didn't like just because I'm it's not good advice for me, that I think has a good application for activists. He talks about like a low information diet or not reading the news and not reading stuff or not like tuning into stuff that you don't need to know about. And like, I think that's in general, I don't like the premise of don't keep up with politics and events as advice for me, because that is important to the work that I do. But I think a place that we could really strongly apply it for activists is just be conscious of what you are giving attention to and like how you are spending your focus towards the benefit of your project. So that might be not looking at the news, that might be not looking at trailers for upcoming movies or video games or whatever it is that people like to distract themselves with when they're on the hunt for a big project. Maybe it's better to focus more clearly.
Less time watching the juicy drama of streamers.
Yeah, almost exactly what was on the activist front. I think in particular, like the rock solid gold standard platinum steel beam version of this advice is don't pay attention to like weird discourses and interpersonal drama. Don't form parasocial hate relationships. Don't try to solve or resolve arbitrary discourses through public debates and so on. A lot of that stuff, there could be a place for it, but a lot of that stuff is a huge waste of time if you are pursuing doggedly after a project that's meaningful. And I think the project of transforming society will not be resolved in back and forth Twitter or blue sky debates with people who are reading each other uncharitably and they feel that they have to represent some sort of team mentality and they have to determine who's in good pile, who's in bad pile, etc.
Yeah.
I think that doesn't work.
No, definitely. And it's an endless time suck. Social media is addictive in general, but if you're arguing with someone, you can be out of it and then a notification pulls you back in. You're out walking, whatever, you read whatever next dumb thing they said.
All the thrilling and exciting anger returns.
Yeah.
And you're now pumped up and tuned in on some idiot.
Yeah, and you feel right and correct, and you've never felt more clear about why you're correct.
Yeah.
It's an addictive feeling.
It's like this cognitive zit has formed on your prefrontal cortex, and looking at the notification of some dipshit you're arguing with, it makes this huge poppable zit form right on the front of your brain. And looking at the comments section is like looking into a mirror, and it's saying, hey, just take 10 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever it is of your time to really satisfyingly pop this enormous zit and just get it out and just, ugh, I got it out. I said my piece. I got him. And now it's over and no more notifications are coming and I'll never feel this way again. There's something about that kind of like, ugh, I need to get this evil out of me, but just like saying it, it's, yeah, there it is. It's out. I'm free. Now I can move on. That's how it feels to respond to a comment like that to me.
Yeah, and just like real zit popping, if you do it too much, you'll just make it worse.
That's right, yeah.
It'll have a big, giant, red, bulbous, yeah.
Yeah, no, you could get scars from that. You could have worse skin. Really, yeah. We recommend a much deeper and better skincare routine.
Yeah, prevent it in the first place, ideally. And yeah, there's ways to deal with it that are less harsh.
Yeah, so it is. I mean, it's actually a really great metaphor in the sense of like, I think there's more or less dangerous zits to pop. Maybe it's satisfying, but can be messy or disgusting to others. And it can leave you scarred if you do it wrong or too intensely.
Another thought I just had about this book and some of the weirdness of it is like, he talks a bit about trying to avoid meetings at work. And one way is to use the puppy dog closing tactic, or I forget what it was called, something like that.
I remember this.
It's like a sales pitch where you say, if you're not sure if you want the puppy, just take it home for the night and bring it back tomorrow if you don't like it. Most people will never bring it back, but you can get over the hump of uncertainty by framing it as a short-term thing rather than a long-term thing. You can tell your boss, let's try one meeting, just switch it to an email and see how it works. That's a way to get over the hesitance on, let's switch every meeting to an email from now on. Which is, it's, again, good advice at work in that kind of situation. But it also, you can imagine like thinking about the world in general as a series of pitches and meetings and like, how do I get what I want out of this meeting? And like, how do I sell what I'm trying to sell? And like, these kinds of interactions happen all the time. If you're like a freelancer or trying to make things happen in the business world or whatever. But like, there's a certain type of person who starts to treat everything in that sort of way. And you get the sense that they're always trying to pitch you or sell you on something and engaging in these kinds of marketing techniques. It can be very disconcerting. I think this is fine advice for the fallen capitalist business world that currently exists. And
yeah, wrong life can't be lived rightly.
Yeah, but be careful you're not trying to like manipulate people all the time or letting it flow out in ways that are harmful or something.
Yeah, no, I appreciate a good sneaky gesture.
Yeah.
I was recently thinking about what about me likes sneakiness? Where does that instinct come from me? I was reflecting on it, and I think it goes back to childhood and so on, and hiding the chocolate bar in the top drawer and all that kind of stuff. But that's probably like the psychological roots. But there's something so satisfying and fun about different types of sneakiness. So that resonates with me in the book. But there is a danger, and I think you're flagging exactly the right danger, of living a sneaky life is not ideal. And like the best sneaky tricks that I've encountered through, especially like political organizing, are the sneaky tricks that help people realize what their goals really are. Like I think the puppy dog thing of zero risk trial kind of stuff, it is a good psychological thing to be aware of, in that offering that is helping meet someone's psychological need for full knowledge of what they're getting into. And it's undercutting the drive to have an extended discourse about the long-term potential impacts of something by making the stakes lower. Like, I think it's good advice that can be applied at the right time for the right reasons in an ethical way. And living your life as a sneaky, manipulative person is bad. So walking the line between those things, the stuff that I find is most resonant in that sneaky social hacking space is where you can help genuinely meet people's needs with an offer. Like, I think this, like the puppy dog thing is like that, and try it out. See if you like being someone with a puppy, and with the full well that they likely will, and it's still okay to offer. Also, helping to reframe things in ways where people recognize their own interests. You're helping cut through people's cognitive dissonance. One example of this is in fundraising for left-wing organizations, which is something that I've done in various places, but typically fundraising for like political and election campaigns, is you're talking to people who both do want to donate and don't want to donate at the same time. And then the sneaky tricks within that that can help you to get more donations is to help them rectify that tension. In like fundraising, they call it like concern handling or things like that. It's the way that it felt right to me and didn't feel malicious or anything like that is in giving that donation to the outcomes that they want and helping them see how it is meaningful and impactful towards their own goals so they can make the decision in that context. But I think something sneaky like signing someone up for a donation and then hitting a little switch that makes it a monthly donation without their consent, that's like a very wrong type of sneakiness. That's stealing, basically.
Yeah.
But a type of sneakiness that is acceptable is people say, well, I don't have a lot of money right now or whatever. How about if it was $5 per month, then you could help on an ongoing basis and the cost's not too great. That's a pitch that some people find appealing. It's in the tricky toolbox, but it's also helping meet people's needs and it's helping connect their actions to the outcomes that they want. So that's a distinction. But I enjoy sneakiness nonetheless.
Yeah, yeah. And also in the context of against your boss, which is how he presents a lot of this stuff, it feels very justified. And yeah, in terms of fundraising, there's better and worse ways to do it. And that can be a very worthy thing to do. If you just give up on all fundraising because there's no ethical action in capital, like, yeah, it's kneecapping yourself. And like being part of something like a Bernie Sanders, highest number of small donations or whatever, can help people feel like genuinely included in something and more likely to want to participate and contribute in other ways. Or even, yeah, I think there's a lot of ways in which small token donations to organizations can be genuinely something that help people feel hopeful and do more things that they want in their life. But it is still like in a non-ideal situation. And this is an interesting topic, like the sales pitching and like manipulation overlap. Because also I can imagine situations in romantic relationships where there's like some benign, almost like mutually agreed on manipulation, where like you both know that if one person does X thing, the other one is more likely to want to do Y, and you both get a benefit out of that. And the, because it's one of the interesting things too about a lot of those sales pitchy tactics is they work on people even who know about them or even who know that they're being used on them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think there's vistas there of a very open, honest version of these things that are entered into through mutual consent. And yeah, I don't know exactly how that looks, but it's interesting.
It would be fun to do an episode on sneakiness in general.
Yeah.
It's also strangely often just a piece of racial stereotypes. Like I noticed it in high school. I was like, wait, are all the races sneaky? Like that's how it like occurred to me was in doing like an audit of like stereotypes or whatever. I was like, every race. Okay. But anyways, we'll talk about sneakiness someday soon. I'm very interested.
Yeah.
No races are sneaky, for the record. Races don't have essential characteristics. And actually, race is not a scientific category. Racism is the parent, not the child of race, just to be clear. We did an episode, Racism, Not Race. Check it out. Another thing is like just in the liberatory angle of some of the stuff he talks about, like outsourcing needed work, registers with me on the front of like delegating work in a group and like the benefits of distributing work and like preventing like superhero culture, which is a big problem in activist communities where you have one or two people burning themselves out 7 days a week to keep everything together for people quietly. And like automation tools like automatically responding emails or meeting invites that are on a schedule that go out automatically and stuff like that. That type of automation is really useful, but I think more so than hiring low-wage workers in the developing world in exploited countries that, for the record, have significant resource bases that are essentially stolen from the people through legal and economic means. Instead of that, I think distributing out work in ways that are like equitable between people and so on is like a good principle. And trying to automate redundant work with better tools is also a very good thing.
Automating redundant work is a wonderful thing. I've always loved that. And the times in my life that I've done extremely redundant work has always been the most horrifying jobs. Like stacking bricks. I don't know if you've ever stacked like multiple pallets of bricks that were knocked over by a forklift in the sun in the summer when you're 12 years old. But stacking one pallet of bricks is okay. It's kind of fun. You turn chaos back into order, but it gets old, which is the problem with all repetitive work, is it gets old pretty quick. And
yeah, I've done other repetitive work, but not that one. In this hot sun, I used to work at the airport for a cruise line, moving all the tourist luggage onto conveyor belts that were going to planes, and then also vice versa. And backbreaking stuff. Although overall of like the jobs I had when I was in my 20s, I've got a certain fondness for that job just because it was great exercise. It got me up at the break of dawn and I was able to like organize my life around it in a good way. But there were some days that were just like, it was just constant. And that kind of extending forever to infinity experience is like my least favorite part of work and jobs. I noticed after about the length of a school year, at any job, so about 9-10 months, I start getting this like really, really strong fucking run away as fast as I can energy, because it just feels like it feels like I'm trapped in purgatory forever.
Yeah, the sameness and the, yeah, I agree.
The last positive thing I want to say about this book, and there's probably more, there's also more negative things I didn't get to, but the last positive thing I want to say in how to apply this for like social liberation, one of the philosophical points he makes is like, retiring and having tons of free time when you're very old sucks compared to having a lot of free time when you're young. And he suggests, instead of planning for retirement, plan to have a work life that involves sabbaticals, like gaps in work that are 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, a year, that you can come back to life afterwards, but try to like configure and design your life to have time away from work while you are, for lack of a better term, in the prime of your life, and that where you have the energy to do what you want and so on. And I think there's definitely a type of truth in that. and directly applying it to activists, like, I think breaks from work and not doing that like superhero burnout indefinite to infinity stuff is really important. But then also politically, I think we should try to establish a work-life balance for the people of the world that does give them significant batches of free time and sabbaticals, the same way that the weekend is enshrined in law.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say too, is it's another one where there's this kernel of something I like, which is like, yeah, that really does suck. It would be so much more powerful a vision if, yeah, you're talking about this should be the rule instead of like, oh, you get to retire at 65 or conservatives want to keep pushing it up and then you get Social Security finally or the CPP, Canada Pension. Instead of that, saying that people deserve long sabbaticals, that should be part of a well-functioning vacation system where you get at least 1 year off every 5 years or something like that. I don't know. We'll work it out. I think that's a great system and it would really help people return refreshed. And
it's a great example of, again, said this near the beginning, but like the fundamental issue is this book diagnoses some of the malaise of living as a working subject, a working class person under capitalism, where you are overexploited and underpaid and we're sold a false bill of goods and dreams about what makes life good. And the false thing we're sold is that what makes life good is more money at any cost. And I think this book correctly identifies that there's more important things than money as part of its self-help guide towards making money. That's true. So it's identifying something that's wrong with society that's right, but then it's providing an escape hatch that is individualistic and structurally could only ever be to the benefit of a fraction of the population and at the expense of another part of the population. And so that's where it goes wrong. It's like talking about individual liberation in the sense that this book does carries a certain type of perversion to me, in that I think of the word liberation as referring to something that belongs to a much wider group of people with a certain sympathy for like pirate. It's basically like pirate liberation. It's like liberation for yourself, maybe at the expense of community. And I'm a little bit sympathetic to that in a dirtbag kind of way. But I think in terms of a project to address the issues that this book raises, the right issues about what it's like to work, what it's like to, how retirement works, all these kind of questions, then the answer is a collective project. And the answer is utilizing some of these tools, perhaps, to actualize that project, to achieve things for people, set up durable social institutions that can challenge and transform things that are wrong with society and create a work culture that's balanced for people on a universal basis, where both the knowledge worker reading this book in the year 2007 and their $4 an hour employee on the other side of the world are both being moved towards liberatory outcomes, not one at the expense of the other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is the thesis of the actual real 4-hour work week, full program, wrong boys style, working title, but you get the idea. I think we can create a brighter future where when people say the 4-hour work week and they're talking about a book, his is just a footnote to our much better replacement.
Yeah, yeah. And more popular, more influential. You know what? I'll even dare say it, more profitable.
Yeah.
And then we're going to hire people at lower wages in developing countries with that funds just to advocate for their own communities. So basically giving them full-time wages to do political activism and action within their own communities towards the glorious transformative project. That way we are taking advantage of that arbitrage, but to the benefit of those communities instead of ourselves. I think that may be another little spin on this classic 2007 self-help book.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Wow. But I think we've really plumbed the depths here. I mean, there always could be more to talk about, but seems like we're running out of time, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
I could talk all day, and I would love to. And we're going to talk about sneakiness soon. Sound off in the comments if you've got thoughts on sneakiness.
Yeah.
That'll be in that pipeline somewhere. I want to do it. I like sneakiness. I'm really fascinated in that.
Yeah, like develop a theory of pro-social and anti-social sneakiness and how to navigate the line there, and also, as well as a sort of historical overview of sneakiness. There's a lot to get into, for sure.
So it may take many years for us to complete it based on the scale of the project we're undertaking, but we're
yeah, to fully encapsulate sneakiness.
Every dimension. When people tune into the show, they need every dimension of an issue reflected in that hour, 2 hour runtime.
Yeah.
So that's all the time that we have this week. Thanks for listening, sharing, talking, engaging in the comment sections. We'll be back soon with more discussions on things and funny little voices. And yeah, thanks sincerely to everyone for listening and for donating on Patreon. If you do, if you don't, maybe today's the day. Maybe just do it for a night. Go in for 1 month.
Yeah, you can always cancel after 1 day.
You can get a taste of what it feels like to be one of in that beautiful, wonderful community.
You could go in, listen to all the old bonus episodes in 1 month and get a big hit, so to speak, for cheap. Really game the system.
Yeah, I strongly agree that is possible. You can be sneaky that way. Thanks for listening, everybody. Yeah.
Have a great week.
See ya.